I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Six police officers, six defendants, six trials. Baltimore Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams ruled Wednesday that each police officer accused in the Freddie Gray case must be tried separately. WYPR's P. Kenneth Burns joins me in Studio A to discuss the judge's decision, and will assess the consequences of it with University of Baltimore law professor J. Amy Dillard. How will these rulings affect legal strategy? What's the potential effect of six trials on the city in light of April's riot? Could the trial still be moved out of Baltimore? All that coming up on Midday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. In Hour 2 today, Sherry Parks will be back with us, our American culture commentator, for a look at the modern civil rights movement. Black Lives Matter? What does the modern civil rights leader look like? Does the traditional model of the wise man leading a march hold? And if so, who is that wise man or woman speaking truth to power today? Our guest in the second hour, along with Sherry Parks, DeRay McKesson, named by the Los Angeles Times as one of the new civil rights leaders of the 21st century, has used social media to heighten awareness of threats to civil rights, calling out police and policies from Ferguson to Baltimore, organizing protests and demonstrations. He's from Baltimore. DeRay McKesson was on our show, in fact, on May 1st, the day charges were announced against the six police officers in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. DeRay McKesson back on the show today for a conversation with Sherry Parks in the second hour, Midday on American Culture. In this hour, we're going to recap what happened yesterday in Baltimore Circuit Court in the courtroom of Judge Barry Williams, where the judge heard and then acted on motions from the defense lawyers in the case of the six officers in the Freddie Gray case. And so P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff was there yesterday. I was there as well. But we thought we'd recap here a little bit and then talk about, get some analysis of the judge's rulings from J. Amy Dillard, a professor at the University of Baltimore Law School. But I will start with P. Kenneth Burns. Nice to see you again, Kenny.
Thank you, Daniel.
So let's go over this. First, there was a session in the morning where motions were heard. Arguments were heard on motions to dismiss the case altogether, and also a motion to have state's attorney Marilyn Mosby and her staff recused from the case. So let's start with the first one, the argument for dismissal.
Yeah, the defense was asking for the charges to be dismissed because of prosecutorial misconduct. That means, in layman's terms, state's attorney Marilyn Mosby abused her power and overreached. And I'm trying to keep this, use as many layperson terms as possible, because there was a lot of legalese yesterday.
She was accused of violating professional misconduct, professional rules of conduct for lawyers by making statements about the case that she shouldn't have, according to the defense.
Right. Particularly on that May 1st news conference, she made statements that were against the professional ethics and caused a bunch of pretrial publicity. She was actually answering a reporter's question asking if the officers cooperated.
With the investigation.
She answered it at first, and then you could tell on the tape, I can't really get into that because of ethics. I can't discuss
that. She tried to stop herself. She made some utterance that the defense used and tried to exploit in this hearing yesterday, saying that that was unprofessional and prejudicial to the case. And we actually have that clip, so we'll listen to that now.
Did the officers, cooperative with your investigation?
Yes.
All six?
No. They gave a statement, and I can't get too far into the facts of this case.
Go ahead, sir. I can't
answer that.
So those are the four words that the defense focused on?
Among others. And
they said there were four words, right?
There were four words.
Yeah, right.
And this particular part, the judge said that was troubling because she broke the rules, essentially, by tipping the hand.
Also, the whole atmosphere of the announcement of the charges, the defense said this was like a...
Sort of like a pep rally
to, you know, heighten emotions about the case.
Heighten emotions.
Poison the potential jury pool out there.
Rebel rouse the crowd, in other words, to against the officers to try to seek the conviction.
Ultimately, the judge ruled in favor of the state's attorney, saying that, I guess, agreeing with the argument of Michael Schatzow, the deputy chief state's attorney, that the defense had, you know, distorted what the Marilyn Mosby had said, and that Marilyn Mosby's statements didn't go much beyond the statement of facts, a statement of charges against the officers.
Right, and even still, a lot of the issues that the defense raised, he says, it's not a matter for my courtroom because I don't have that authority. You have to go to the grievance commission.
On the second motion for recusal of the state's attorney's office, the judge seemed to be almost incredulous that they even brought this motion.
I would say he saved some of his more acidic comments when he was reading his decision there. Particularly, the defense cited the relationship between Marilyn Mosby and City Councilman Nick Mosby.
They're married. The judge found that...
Troubling and condescending.
The insinuation that she is somehow prejudiced because of this or that this is inappropriate, conflict, right?
And in fact, he asked, can she not think for herself?
Right. Anyway, he dismissed that, too.
He dismissed.
Says you can't recuse the entire state's attorney's office. Okay, that was the morning. And then the afternoon comes, and that's where the surprise was in the day.
That was a surprise. I think a Baltimore Sun columnist wrote it from the Freddie Gray 6 to the Freddie Gray 1 times 6.
The Freddie Gray 1 at a time times 6,
one
right?
One at a time times 6.
The Judge Barry Williams decided that all six officers should be tried separately.
Right. Janice Bledsoe, who was the... prosecutor who argued on behalf of the state to join Nero, Miller, and White, of Goodson, Miller, and White in one case. And then basically they were going to try them in groups. And the respective defense attorneys argued that's not fair because what one is found guilty of, that's going to be unfairly applied to all the other clients.
It'll taint the case.
It'll taint the
defense of the others.
Better yet, their clients wouldn't get a fair trial. And Judge Williams agreed with that and said that it wouldn't be in the interest of justice to try them together. He talked about the reckless endangerment charge, which all six were charged with. I mean, the state was trying to use that as a linchpin, but he said that the evidence does not tie everybody together.
Officer Cesar Goodson Jr., who drove the police van in which Freddie Gray sustained injuries, is charged with second-degree depraved heart murder. Sergeant Alicia White, Lieutenant Brian Rice, and Officer William Porter are charged with manslaughter. Officers Edward Nero and Garrett Miller, who Candy Burns just referred to, face lesser charges, including second-degree assault. All six have been charged also with misconduct.
And let me correct some of that I just said. It was actually they wanted to charge Goodson, Nero, and White in a group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now the judge is saying in order for there to be fair trials— they must be separate trials. J. Amy Dillard joining us again, professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, who's been with us before to analyze steps in the Freddie Gray case. Thanks for being with us again, Amy.
Happy to be here.
So the prospect of six trials, let's talk about that a little bit. Did it surprise you that the judge ruled that way?
It did not. And I say that, of course, not knowing all the evidence in the case, but given what we've been able to glean from the pleadings and from the reports and from things Mosby has said, we know that officers made statements, some of these six officers made statements in the investigation. And, you know, those statements will likely be admissible at trial against those individual officers, but they might not be admissible at trial against other officers. And so if you think about a courtroom where, let's say, we had White, Goodson, and Miller, who I think were bundled together by the state's attorney because they would be able to tell the entire story through those three prosecutions, Miller during the arrest, White during the loading of the van, and then Goodson as the driver of the van. You know, if Miller said something about what White did— that may not be admissible in White's trial. What you might get is a spillover effect where things that are relevant in prosecuting one defendant are not relevant and admissible in prosecuting another defendant. And so the court had to see that there was enough evidence that would demand him assessing its admissibility in the middle of a joint trial to reach the conclusion that joinder just wouldn't be in the interest of justice for the defendants, that in order to have a fair trial, they were entitled to have a trial only of the evidence that was relevant in their prosecution and not against other people.
Right. So you have officers who were involved in the actual arrest of Freddie Gray, chasing him and arresting him.
Right.
And then you have some involved in loading him in a van and
right.
one involved in actually driving the van.
Right. So if you think about it, let's say that, you know, if Porter, Rice, and White come and they do the loading into the van, then Nero and Miller's involvement in the chronology of events, you know, their personal involvement ends. And to allow the jury to hear evidence about what happened after Freddie Gray had been driven away from them or loaded into a van where maybe they weren't even present, and then what happened during the ride in that van would be prejudicial to their prosecution, which is for a lesser charge. And, you know, which is a more limited amount of interaction with Freddie Gray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether or not they assaulted Freddie Gray during the arrest, all that information is relevant in their trial. Whether or not Goodson slammed on the brakes or gave a rough ride or what we've read about, you know, that happened 10, 15 minutes later if it happened. It happened away from Miller and Nero.
Right.
It happened not in their presence, not in their sight. And, you know, unless she had some theory that all these people had conspired to do this, which I gather she doesn't, given that it wasn't presented yesterday, it's hard to tie them together without some prejudice.
And the reason why, so I just want to make sure I understand, mm-hmm. Nero and Miller, for instance, aren't together. Is because of statements one or both might have made.
I think that's right. And we don't know what those statements are.
No. Uh-huh.
And there are ways to try individuals together where it's complicated, I guess I would say, how the evidence is admitted and not admitted against one or the other. But, you know, I gather that what was important to Mosby or important to the state's attorney was trying Goodson, White, and Miller together. And, you know, Miller's at the arrest,
mm-hmm.
White's loading in the van, and Goodson's driving around. And I saw those three as being bound together. The motivation for binding them together from the state's attorney is they wanted to be able to tell the whole story to a jury. And they wanted to be able to tell it from start to finish.
Right, a narrative.
To one jury, yeah.
Yep.
And
yep.
If you think about it, the trial of Nero and Miller just ends when they hand Gray over to the other officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so you only look at their limited conduct. And, you know, and so from the defense attorney point of view, that's what the jury for them should look at, only their limited conduct and not the conduct of Goodson 20 minutes later.
Did the judge take, I don't want to say the easy way out, but I'm just wondering, is it easier to err if he's erring? I don't know if he's erring. He's just saying, it's too complicated to try to do it any other way. We don't want to prejudice anyone's case, so just separate them all.
It's a great question. And I definitely think that severing all six into individual trials is a couple of things. One, the most protective of the defendant's due process rights,
mm-hmm.
And probably creates a simpler trial for each of the six individuals, meaning there are fewer arguments about evidence and its admissibility and its prejudice in each individual trial. There are ways to, you know, try defendants together, but typically, the government has to assert something other than it's just cheaper and easier for us, like something like these two people worked in concert together, either as accomplices or as co-conspirators. That's the typical rationale for joining trials together, and I haven't seen any of that asserted by the state's attorney's office in this case. In fact, to the contrary, based on the charges that she has brought, they're all brought under a theory of negligence, rather than under a theory of intentional conduct. And it's only in intentional conduct cases that you see accomplice liability and you see conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
In fact, the judge said yesterday that the state didn't bring any conspiracy charges for any of the defendants.
Right.
But, Amy, I wanted to ask you, could this be sort of a blessing in disguise that you have six separate trials and that...
A blessing for which side?
For the prosecution, because, I mean, think about this. If you had a joinder or you had joint trials, there is some evidence that might not get admitted if you had the multiple defendants, and they were prosecuted in groups.
Interesting.
I tend to think of this now more in terms of just as a judge, which is that it is just cleaner. It's much easier to answer questions of due process and prejudice and material evidence when you're only addressing it in the context of one defendant, you know, with one primary charge against them. While they have some secondary charges against them, we all know what the primary charges are, whether second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, or second-degree assault. So I see it as a way to just treat each of these individuals as they are individuals, absent any theory that they should be treated as acting as a collective. So I don't see that there's much prejudice to either side for doing that. I don't see any prejudice to the state for severing the trials, and I only see, the possibility of fewer errors happening at trial.
Amy, can you stay on the line?
Of course.
Oh, I'm so glad because I have so many more questions to ask you about these proceedings yesterday. J. Amy Dillard, University of Baltimore law professor, P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff with us for this hour of the show as we go over these rulings made yesterday by Judge Barry Williams in the Freddie Gray case, originally the Freddie Gray 6, now the Freddie Gray one at a time six trials. 410-662-8780 is our phone number if you have a question for Amy or Kenny Burns. Email. Yeah, our email address is midday@wypr.org. And this is Midday. Dan Rodericks here with P. Kenneth Burns, Kenny Burns of the WYPR news staff, and University of Baltimore law professor J. Amy Dillard, talking about these rulings made by Judge Barry Williams in Baltimore's Circuit Court. The judge ruled that the case against six Baltimore police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray will go forward, but in separate trials, and that the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, will remain in charge of the prosecution. Her office was not recused or forced to be recused. Pardon my verbiage here.
She's not getting taken off the case.
Yes, right, because that's one of the things that the defense had asked for. So, Amy Dillard, I have a bunch of questions for you, I'm going to defer to Dawn in Annapolis, one of our listeners, to get our listeners involved in this.
Okay.
Dawn has a question.
Hey,
go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much, Dan. With respect to change of venue, now that there are six trials, what is the opportunity for changing the venue of, say, three of the six to another venue? And quite honestly, we're concerned in Annapolis that if it comes here, we're going to have protests here and a bunch of outside agitators who can't even spell Freddie Gray's name right.
Oh, that's a nice thing to say, Don.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for adding that in there. Okay, let's go over the change of venue. I'm so glad we put Don on the air. But that's going to come up next week, September 10th. The judge will be asked to consider moving the case out of Baltimore City. The fact that he's already ordered separation of the cases, I don't know if that matters so much. You have to make one. I would imagine, Amy, that one argument would apply to all six defendants, no?
I think so. I mean, the main argument here is going to be publicity, and that you've got a potential jury pool in Baltimore City that's been saturated by publicity and saturated by opinions and comments and news reports, so that they know about the case or they think they know facts about the case that might not be presented at an individual's trial. you might think of it this way. If you are representing, say, Miller and Nero, the arresting officers, and now their trials have been severed from the others, then, you know, Goodson's conduct is likely not admissible in their trial for second-degree assault. If you had a jury pool that, you know, had been saturated in the information about the entire incident, defense attorneys, I think, would have a good argument that those charged with lesser offenses, those whose involvement doesn't stretch out to the van in any way, would be entitled to have jurors hear their case who have not been saturated by the entire story. That's how I think the argument would look. Of course, you know, the response, I suspect, is that, and I, you know, I live in the D.C., I live, you know, in Virginia, but I live in the D.C. area, and the coverage has been broad down here, meaning it's not just coming out of Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it stretches across the rest of Maryland, because, you know, Maryland has such distinct regions to it. But certainly in the metropolitan area of Baltimore, Washington, I think that the coverage has been fairly similar, whether you're in Montgomery County or Prince George's County or up in Baltimore.
That brings up an interesting point, Amy. How can you really move the trial out of the city, particularly between the two metro areas? Because you had the D.C. press covering the trial yesterday. And
I wonder what the argument for it is, though.
That's where I was
going. How do you prove that you can't, you couldn't get an impartial jury? You have to conduct a public opinion survey of some kind?
Yeah, but keep this in mind, Dan. They have cable on the Eastern Shore. They have cable in Western Maryland. So
how do you determine that you couldn't find
an impartial jury
here
anywhere
in Baltimore, or juries, because it's plural now?
Right. So the way that works typically is there is an analysis done of the coverage, and not just the coverage that we think of as reporting, but also opinion writing and commentary that's been done as well, where that's been done. So, you know, you say, well, let's just only look at the Baltimore Sun for a second, and what that distribution level is and where it is. So the analysis is not, asking individuals in the initial assessment of where the trial should be, asking individuals whether they know about this or not, but rather the judge trying to make an objective decision about what the level of coverage has been, how much it has saturated. And I think the answer to those two is a lot. But then of that coverage, what of it has been of a nature that might bias potential jurors or might give them information that would be excluded at a criminal trial? That's really what he's looking for. You don't want a juror going back into the room having heard the evidence, let's say, against Nero and White, and say, well, I know we didn't hear this in the trial today, but I read the paper and I know, mm-hmm. and bringing extrinsic evidence or facts outside of the trial in.
Okay. I want to go back to the separation question, mm-hmm. and this calls for speculation, Your Honor, but Amy Diller, this is just a radio show. We're not in the courtroom. So what's your approach to this if you're Marilyn Mosby, Michael Schatzow, and it's Janet Bledsoe, right?
Yes,
Janice. You're the staff there at the state's attorney's office looking at this today, thinking, oh, wow, we got six trials. So what's our approach to this? The Sun today suggested that the state probably has most of the say over who goes first in terms of which defendant.
I think that's right, but I do think that it could be a part of the judge's venue ruling next week, meaning that, you think of it this way. Let's say you begin with the trial of Goodson. The driver of the van. Well, in order to do, I think, a proper prosecution of the driver of the van, you probably have to bring in evidence about the loading of the van and probably some about the arrest at the scene. In a trial of Goodson, which we would think might be the most in-depth of the and the most extensive of all six, it may be that publicity is generated from that trial that would affect the fair prosecution of the other defendants. You know, there might be so much publicity and media around a trial of Goodson that that might continue to saturate the potential jury pool for Nero and Miller, let's say. So I could imagine that, you know, as part of the decision in the change of venue, consideration of who goes first and how that happens will be also taken up.
And then there's the prospect raised by your point about saturation of news coverage of getting potentially six impartial juries impaneled?
Well, you know, you still get – you have to remember that, you know, we think of how much we've read about this case, but not everybody has read as much as we have. And people get their information from a lot of different sources. And so, you know, it's one thing to be reading all you can, which is, you know, probably what you and I are doing. It's another thing to be reading here and there, not be a subscriber to the paper, having a conversation at work with someone about it. You know, so that everybody may be familiar, but they might not know these minute details that we may have, you know, been purposefully trying to harvest out of news accounts and news reports. The second thing is that, you know, when impaneling the jury during the voir dire process, I mean, those are typical questions. You know, how much do you know about this case? What have you read? What are your news sources? Have you formed an opinion based on what you've read and learned prior to coming in here? Can you put all that out of your mind and pay attention to what's the evidence that's presented at trial? And, you know, I think the hope is that any potential juror, you know, they've taken an oath to tell the truth, they would answer that question truthfully. So that, you know, you and I may have read too – well, I don't live in that city, but, you know, you and I may have read too much so that we would have to honestly say, I've read a lot, and I'm not sure exactly what my opinion is, but I have some.
Right.
And, I think that what the judge and the attorneys have to be looking for are people who, even if they know about this case, haven't been really seeking out facts, and even those facts that they know, they feel like they could put out of their mind, and they would, you know, dutifully try to put them out of their mind and pay attention only to the evidence that's presented at trial.
J. Amy Dillard, our guest in this hour of midday, University of Baltimore law professor. We're discussing Judge Barry Williams' rulings yesterday in Baltimore Circuit Court in the Freddie Gray case. P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff is with us. If you have a question, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780, and our email address for questions that way, midday@wypr.org. Dennis is in Sparks, has a question for us. Go right ahead, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, Dennis. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I have to say I wish I was the judge, because now I would move all six trials to Annapolis.
Now, to move them all to Annapolis? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
My question is, if evidence comes out in one of the earlier trials, during the trial, can it then be used by the attorneys in a later trial? In other words, if something comes out in court that hasn't been discussed or exposed yet, can they then use it, you know,
it's a great question.
In one of the later trials?
It's a great question, and this is how that typically works. You know, when witnesses have testified under oath, whether in a trial or a deposition or another setting, that becomes potential evidence to be used in other cases and in other situations. And the reason is it's sworn, so it's treated as if it were true because it's been sworn. And, you know, you could imagine that someone in a subsequent trial, let's say in trial number six, makes a statement, you know, I don't know, the sky was blue, but they have previously testified that the sky was green. You could bring in that previous testimony to show that they had made a prior inconsistent statement and for other reasons. So, yes, I think it potentially does become evidence that may be relevant and admissible at future trials.
Kenny Burns.
Amy, what is the possibility that these six trials could actually happen simultaneously, or at least three at a time?
It's an interesting question. Given what I know about the number of people who might be involved, that seems hard to manage. I've certainly been involved in cases like that, you know, where you have three defendants, let's say in a robbery prosecution, who are being tried separately but simultaneously. So you have three trials running in three courtrooms. And, you know, the witness testifies in courtroom one and then goes to courtroom two and then goes to courtroom three. That is manageable in my experience, where you have two or three witnesses and one police officer, you know, who's testifying. this sounds like more testimony is going to come out. And so that seems like a logistical nightmare if I was the judge.
It also strikes me as unfair to the state.
Unfair to the state.
You're asking a prosecutor's office to deploy
resources.
Deploy, you know, mm-hmm. two or three teams of prosecutors.
I
guess it's possible. I suppose they have the man-woman power to do it. But
we do tend to think of these as, you know, the most serious high-profile cases are taken on by the folks who have the most experience and the most experience dealing with the kind of stress that comes not only with prosecuting something serious, but prosecuting something serious in a media environment and doing that in an environment where there may be other stressors coming from the community. Yeah.
Here's another question. This one from Bob in Baltimore. Bob, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Dan. Thanks. Great show.
Thanks.
My question is there a strategy in deciding which cases you want to try first? I heard someplace else that they might try to go for the easiest conviction first and get that rolling. I'm just wondering, what's the strategy in deciding in what order you're going to try these officers?
Calls for speculation, Your Honor.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, it's, and I'll say this, as someone who was never a prosecutor but was only a defense attorney, you know, the idea of the things that I'm most likely to get a conviction in, you know, I might just think of it as, what are the simplest trials to put on? Meaning, what are the cases with the fewest witnesses, with the fewest theories that I have to develop and explain to the jury? What are the ones that offer sort of the easiest questions for the jury to have to decide? And, you know, in my view, those are likely the two assault prosecutions. You know, they're less serious charges. But that's also intentional conduct. You know, the argument is that if you think of it in a simple terms, you know, Jim punched Don. And so the evidence is, did Jim punch Don? And did somebody see it mm-hmm. happen, that it was intentional conduct? The other prosecutions, you know, from the van loaders to Goodson, that involves a theory that the prosecutor has to develop, that theory being that these officers engaged in some conduct that was overtly, catastrophically negligent, and that catastrophic negligence caused the death of Freddie Gray. That's something you have to develop. That's a little harder for lay people and first-year law students and about everybody I ever talked to, you know, for them to understand, because it requires you to take some rules of law and try to put them into, you know, an everyday factual setting and make a decision based on it. So I think those are just more complex because, you know, it's something that people are less familiar with.
Amy, one more question before the next break, and then I hope you can stay because I still have some more questions. Is that all right, Professor?
I blocked an hour for you.
Oh,
Dan.
Excellent.
I'm
Thank
here.
You very much.
Okay.
All right. Walter wants to know, if the trials are moved to other jurisdictions, would judges from other circuits preside over the trial, or would a city judge travel to those other jurisdictions?
So I don't know the Maryland rule on that, and there probably isn't one, and it would likely be a judge in the jurisdiction where the trial has been moved to. But I don't know the Maryland rule on that. That's how they've been handled in some cases where I've had to deal with a venue change. You know, usually what they're looking for is a jurisdiction that is comparable in terms of jury pool makeup, whether that's based on age, race, economic positions, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to move it to someplace that looks statistically similar.
You know, I've been a reporter in Baltimore almost 40 years, and I was scratching my head yesterday trying to think of a change of venue case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to think one off. I'm sure we've had some, but The most recent one
I could think of was an Eastern Shore case,
right.
And it was moved from, I think, Wicomico County to Cecil County.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know of one that's been moved from Washington County out to the Eastern Shore. And you know, those are fairly easy, jurisdictions to compare to one another in terms of population and density and that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, your caller from Annapolis is probably thinking, is Annapolis the only other jurisdiction that is the same size as Baltimore?
Yeah. We're going to take a break here. We'll come back some more questions for J. Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore School of Law and P. Kenneth Burns of the WIPR news staff, who's with me, Dan Rodericks, for this hour of midday. We'll be right back. Alan has a question. Alan in Charles North, listening to our show here, the Midday Show, says, given that, one, the autopsy showed no evidence of injuries other than to Mr. Gray's spinal cord, which was deemed to have occurred in the transport van, and two, that the false imprisonment charges against officers Nero and Miller were dropped after the debate over the legality of the knife that was found on Freddie Gray, has the prosecutor presented any evidence which would support the assault and misconduct charges against the arresting officers? As far as evidence goes, there's been no evidence presented yet. But anyway, it seems as though, here's his point, the arresting officers have been dragged into the real and viable case against the transport team.
Right. Well, the false imprisonment charges were dropped against four of the officers, Lieutenant Brian Rice, Officer Nero, Officer Miller, and Sergeant White. Okay. They were substituted with a second count of misconduct in office for the illegal arrests surrounding the knife. So that was addressed during the grand jury, hence the indictment of the charges and why they shifted a little bit.
Oh, so they actually changed the type of charge.
Yes.
But it relates to the same idea, same theory.
Yes.
Okay. So, all right, so the arresting team is not off the hook. It's just that, you know, in court yesterday, the defense was talking about the spillover effect if you had multiple defendants or even co-defendants,
right,
that could occur. And so the judge went for separation. That's what we're talking about today. Amy, I had a question for you about the other aspect that we covered earlier, Marilyn Mosby's conduct on May 1st, the day the charges were announced, the statements that she made to the world and to the press, and the defense considered inappropriate, more than inappropriate, but actual violations of the Maryland lawyer's code of professional conduct, saying that these utterances caused the case to be prejudiced. It potentially poisoned the jury pool in Baltimore by suggesting that the officers were guilty. You know, if you're a prosecutor, doesn't a prosecutor have the right to say, I'm bringing these charges against this person because I think they're guilty, to make statements like that? I was just wondering, you know, what is a prosecutor allowed to say when charges are announced to the public?
Well, I suppose if you read those rules pretty narrowly, the answer to that is not much. You know, the real problem comes when a prosecutor speaks about the strength of the evidence, the testimony that she expects from particular witnesses, because the theory is that she's trying to bolster her case or trying to demonstrate to the public the relative strength of her case. You know, when a prosecutor says, I conducted a grand jury and the grand jury indicted these six people, that statement speaks for itself, meaning that she wouldn't have bothered taking it to the grand jury if she didn't have some professional opinion about, you know, how the grand jury would react to that evidence. And once the grand jury indicts, then that tells us that the grand jury found that there was probable cause to believe these officers committed these offenses. It's the next step of talking about the nature and quality of the evidence, the strength of it, the reliability of it, that poses the problem for her. And I mean, I got to say, you know, friends that I have who prosecute in Maryland, the day that they, you know, heard her press conference, they quickly said, "Whew, that's pushing it."
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no doubt that that she's gone up to or over the line on what's allowed under the rules.
Well, I also say I draw on my experience again as a reporter, just observing life here the last three or four decades. I've never saw anything like that. Of course, people will say, well, we've never been through an extraordinary experience like this. Someone said that yesterday.
I don't want to suggest that she's going to be found to have violated any of the Maryland rules. I'm just going to say that given what I've seen and others who have witnessed press conferences after charges have been brought and people who are prosecutors in Maryland, they would say they've not gone that far in talking about a case that's been indicted and they're preparing for trial.
Yeah, yesterday during the, particularly the morning session The defense brought up the Gansler rule. This is referring to now former Attorney General Doug Gansler, when he was still state's attorney in Montgomery County. He has gave some reporters remarks for a 1993 triple murder to the effect that he said, I'm going to offer this guy a plea bargain. That was a no-no. And this went for just about a decade to all the way up to the Court of Appeals to kind of iron out what a state's attorney can and cannot say before a trial.
Didn't they sanction him or censure him?
Got sanctioned.
Yeah. The judge said yesterday, Judge Williams said, it was not within his authority to decide whether Marilyn Mosby had broken the Maryland lawyer's rules of professional conduct. Mm-hmm. That was for the Attorney Grievance Commission, he said. The commission investigates and prosecutes alleged violations of those rules. This is the judge's quote. While the day may come or may not come when the words of the state's attorney will be assessed, parsed, and dissected for the purpose of determining if there were violations of the rules of professional conduct, today is not that day.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, what he's really, I think, concluding is that whatever the defense has asserted that she said on that day, which, you know, we're all able to see because it was in a press conference, and however they've argued that that was a violation of the Maryland rules of professional conduct, I didn't see much argument about why the remedy for that violation should be a dismissal of the charges, meaning you can argue that she's done something wrong, but then you have to connect the remedy that you're seeking, dismiss this case, as proper in the context of the misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where a prosecutor engages in misconduct during a trial or by not turning over evidence or not, you know, not alerting to witnesses that they plan to call, something that happens during the trial that affects the trial and affects the due process of the defendant in that trial, that's where the remedy tends to be related to the trial in some way. And here, I just think he was concluding long before he took the bench yesterday that wasn't the proper remedy, even
right,
if she did violate the code, the
right,
Maryland rules.
I must say, I enjoyed watching Judge Williams in action, his comments and his parrying with the lawyers yesterday. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting.
Very
Get me in next time. I'll come with you.
Oh, okay.
Get
yeah.
Get in if you're just, you know,
all right,
an interested person.
Well, it's next week. It's September 10th. Will be the next.
Yeah.
If you don't have a class, maybe
yeah,
we can.
Maybe we can.
We'll work that out, Amy. But
okay.
Yeah, he was very good. There was a little bit of back and forth about the question of whether it was in the interest of public safety or in the public's interest for Marilyn Mosby to announce these charges in War Memorial,
right,
at the Baltimore War Memorial on May 1st in such a public way. And the judge said, are you saying that it's a prosecutor's job, a state's attorney's job, to bring calm to the city? Because I don't think it is.
Right. This was surrounding comments where she asked for the residents who were protesting, calm down,
right,
I need your peace so
right,
I could prosecute, or particularly, she said, bring justice for Freddie Gray.
Right.
And the judge took some umbrage with that. He wanted to know, well, he said flat out, it's not a prosecutor's job to calm the crowd down.
Right, right.
But watching Judge Williams at work was really interesting.
Yeah, it was. He was funny.
He was funny.
At moments, yeah.
And very no-nonsense. In fact, the morning session proved how no-nonsense he was. He gave each side 15 minutes to argue their point. And then after the morning session, we cannot ignore the fact that he read the Riot Act to both sides.
We don't want to leave that out. Yeah.
Yeah. He essentially said, look, let's focus on the law. Stop trying to get the best sound bites for the press.
Right.
Yeah.
The court doesn't want to wade through the rhetoric in order to get to the legal argument that's important.
Yeah. And some of these motions, the overwrought language and rhetoric and prose that used in them, I'm a little surprised at it.
And we saw that during the morning session.
Yeah, some of it.
Yeah.
It's a great lesson for all lawyers and particularly law students that, you know, it's not only what you say in a courtroom publicly, but it's also, you know, everything you write on a piece of paper that you file and make public, those are your words too. And I think he reminded them, you know, sometimes a little easier to write something that you think is pushing the rules of civility, things you wouldn't say in open court that you might write down. And I think he said, look, your pleadings are speaking for you. And I'm reading them as if you're speaking, and I want you to abide by the rules in your pleadings as well as what you say in court.
Amy, here's a question from one of our listeners, Jeff. Pretty interesting question. Just wondering if the fact that Baltimore City residents have a vested interest in seeing these officers convicted to avoid further riots, whether that would come into play in the decision on whether or not to move the trials from Baltimore.
I don't think so. I think that the question of venue change always comes under the would the trial be fair for the defendants? Could the defendants have a fair trial in the jurisdiction given the potential jury pool and how much they may know about the case and how biased they may be from that information? So I don't, if you think of it this way, and I teach this all the time, the defendant has constitutional rights in a criminal trial. The government doesn't. You know, the constitutional rights that we think of, particularly in the Bill of Rights, those apply to individuals and not to the government and prosecution. So the judge has to be careful that the defendant gets a fair trial, less so that the prosecution gets a fair trial.
Well, that leads into a question I was wondering about, because when they have to play for the other side for the prosecution, because, again, going to pretrial publicity, and as I've alluded to earlier, you have cable in other parts of the state. They're seeing certain images, particularly areas that are perceived to be pro-police, and that the prosecution might not be able to present, might not be able to get a fair shake when they present their case.
I would imagine there'd be questions about that in voir dire, too, wouldn't there, Amy?
I think so. I think it's worth remembering, though, that, you know, if this were a conspiracy trial where the argument was that the Baltimore police were engaging in, you know, concerted action and misconduct related to it, then, you know, other conduct of the police, secondary evidence about other conduct of the police might be more relevant. But you know, this is very individual against each of these officers. Did each person who played a part in the chronology of events in the, you know, at the end of Freddie Gray's life, what was their role? How, if at all, was their conduct negligent? To what level was it negligent? And how did that conduct cause or contribute to Freddie Gray's death? So because of the theory, the specific charges that she's brought and the theories that she has to operate under, they're very individual to these officers.
One quick question from Dave in Baltimore. What role will Freddie Gray's background play in court, if any? Could you imagine Freddie Gray's life story, either his, you know, charges against him, other arrests, or the fact that he was a victim of lead paint poisoning? Would any of that enter into evidence? Could you see that? Imagine that, Amy.
Well, I, you know, it's hard to see it in the prosecution case, meaning that, you know, unless an officer, well, if an officer had specific knowledge about something about Freddie Gray, that might be relevant to how they acted with him. If, for example, if you knew you had a defendant who had a serious mental illness and a tendency for, let's say, biting, officers during an arrest might take extra precautions in securing that person. But I've not read anything that the officers knew anything special about Freddie Gray when this happened, about him being a particular danger or about him having particular vulnerabilities that they needed to take care of. You know, I think he's just like anyone else who gets arrested in Baltimore, and he's, you know, he's entitled to the degree of care, ordinary care, that any of us would be entitled to.
I don't know that we know specifically that any of these officers knew him from before.
Not that I've read.
No. So, yep. Amy, if you want to get in at hearing on Thursday,
I'll call Maureen.
No, I get your email. You can come with me. Call Maureen Harvey, our producer. Amy, this has been great. Thank you very much again for being with us. J. Amy Dillard, professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Thank you, Amy.
You're welcome. Y'all have a good day.
You too. She said y'all, didn't she?
Yeah. Yes, she did.
Kenny Burns, thank you very much for being here, too.
Glad to be here.
P. Kenneth Burns of the WYPR news staff. Please enjoy some lunch from Eddie's of Roland Park, provided today for our guests here on Midday. Please stay tuned for a second hour of our show.